Last month, Dr. Anthony Fauci became the latest career governmental official accused of being part of a deep state conspiracy to undermine President Donald Trump. First, the nation's top infectious diseases expert was attacked after he appeared to mock the president's description of the State Department as the deep state department. Then Fauci was accused of exaggerating the threat posed by the coronavirus to damage the economy and the president's reelection chances. After Fauci received death threats, a team of U.S. marshals was ordered to protect him. But what is the American deep state? Does it really exist? What is it to the right? What is it to the left? And did skepticism of government experts really slow President Trump's response to the coronavirus? Two-time Pulitzer-winning journalist David Rode investigates the deep state in his new book, In Deep, the FBI, the CIA, and the Truth About America's Deep State. He is the executive editor of the New Yorker website and a former Reuters, New York Times, and Christian Science Monitor reporter. And it's a great pleasure to welcome David Rode back to the program. How are you, sir?
I'm great. Thank you, Joe, for having me on the show.
Very nice to have you on the program. I was telling you this before. I learned so much from reading this book, and a lot I didn't know, and it cleared up a lot of things for me. Let's begin with the origin of this term deep state. What do we know about where this term came from?
It was used by political scientists actually to apply to the government in Turkey. And it had to do with the military in Turkey sort of thwarting efforts to introduce democracy in that country. It was sometimes used also in Egypt, same pattern with the Egyptian military trying to slow the introduction of democracy there. The first time I could find that it was applied to the U.S. government was a book by a University of California at Berkeley professor, Peter Dale Scott. In 2007, he wrote a book. And he talked about the American deep state, and I talked to him, I interviewed him for my book, and Scott said that in his view it was really about economic forces. It was kind of Wall Street. He was also afraid of the sort of military-industrial complex, but he felt that those forces were sort of distorting American democracy and thwarting the will of voters. And it really wasn't, though, until after the 2016 election that the deep state term sort of became, I think, much more popularized. And that was an essay on the Breitbart website that said that a battle had begun between the new president, Donald Trump, and the American deep state.
And it's often linked with Steve Bannon, of course, of Breitbart. So what ultimately did he do to kind of change the narrative when it came to the term?
And I first want to say that there is a deep fear of the U.S. government. You mentioned some in your intro. You know, there's a different terminology for it, but liberals, you know, do fear a military-industrial complex. They worry that there's, you know, this cabal of big defense companies and generals pushing the U.S. into endless overseas wars. Conservatives like Bannon and there was an anonymous writer, Virgil, who wrote this first essay at Breitbart, they call it the administrative state. And for conservatives, it's this kind of ever-growing federal government that's constantly and relentlessly invading our lives and sort of taking away our individual rights and liberties and decisions. And that's a wake-up call, I think, for the establishment. I consider myself a kind of mainstream journalist, and I'm, for better or worse, part of this establishment, but many Americans don't really trust it. In terms of that specific essay, the writer, it was a pen name, someone named Virgil, defined the deep state as virtually anyone who works for any government across the U.S. So that would, it included local officials, local teachers, police officers, firefighters, and anyone who kind of benefits from government. That's a more extreme interpretation. And then it's changed to, you know, from that essay, and as the kind of Trump-Russia investigation grows, it shifts, the deep state term shifts from something that Breitbart is using to something that President Trump himself uses.
And then let's just, before we move on, talk a little bit about how the left uses the term.
So I, in an early reaction to the book, there's certain people on the left who think that there's good reason for They're not fans of President Trump, but they also say we shouldn't trust the FBI and the CIA. The book starts out with a history you mentioned. It starts in the mid-1970s. There's a big investigation then by Congress of the FBI and the CIA. It's called the Church Committee, led by Frank Church, a senator from Idaho. They found decades of abuses, that the CIA was surveilling people inside the United States. John Lennon was being followed when he protested the Vietnam War. The FBI was infiltrating and breaking into the houses of members of legitimate political organizations. Martin Luther King famously was targeted by them and other civil rights leaders. And the FBI also targeted the John Birch Society from the conservative side. So that was exposed. All these new safeguards were put in place. But liberals sort of say that just recent failures of the intelligence community, they missed 9/11, the WMD in Iraq, that there is no WMD, and Edward Snowden's revelations of eavesdropping that was wider than people realized, that they really have been discredited. So, you know, their view is that Trump might be exaggerating things, but, you know, our national security establishment, the FBI and the CIA, you know, have to rebuild their reputations. And they're not trusted on the left or the right.
One of the things that you point out, and you alluded to this just a moment ago, that there is a poll, 3/4 of Americans polled believe that a group of unelected government and military officials are secretly manipulating national policy. That clearly means that people are fearful of what is happening.
Yeah, and in the same poll, 8 in 10 Americans felt they were being surveilled in some form by the U.S. government. And this is what I talked about with this kind of wake-up call. I think it's, and you see it with coronavirus, as you mentioned, for better or worse, you know, Americans are deeply skeptical now of journalists, of doctors, of academics. And, you know, we should all take a little time to step back and think of what we're doing wrong. And are there things we could do better? It's also, I think, a byproduct of the digital age. You know, there's more unfiltered information available to folks now than I think any point in arguably human history. Any sort of conspiracy theory, whether it's, you know, for or against, or liberal or conservative, it's a, you know, a half a dozen keystrokes away. Again, I'm biased. I work for The New Yorker. I work for newspapers. There are libel laws. So when I write a story, there's a lawyer that reads it at The New Yorker. I can be sued for libeling someone if I say something that's false or you know, slanders them. Under our current law, Facebook, Twitter, Google face no liability whatsoever for posting material on their platforms that are false and defamatory. It was a loophole that was built in to help the Internet grow years and years ago, but I would kind of urge folks to, I get it, be skeptical of journalists, but please be skeptical as well of the things you're reading that are just posted on Twitter and Facebook that, you know, there's no legal ramifications if you lie, there's no sort of fact-checking, and there's just a lot of, you know, disinformation and misinformation floating out there.
In the prologue to the book, you write, 3 years into the Trump presidency, deep state has become part of the Trumpian lexicon, along with witch hunt and fake news. President Trump himself increasingly invokes the term. In 2009, he used it at least 23 times, twice the number that he did in 2018. The president and his supporters blame the deep state for leaks, including the one I wrote about for Reuters, that disparage him. They blame it for Trump's impeachment. Mike Rogers, a Republican congressman from Alabama, decried it on the floor of the House during the final impeachment debate. This is a sad day for our nation when one political party, along with their cohorts in the deep state and the mainstream media, try to hijack our Constitution. What should I know what just my knee-jerk trouble is with that, but what should our deeper concern be with the increased use of that term, which ultimately legitimizes it?
So, and I really try to be there in the book. And what Representative Rogers and others are talking about is a core thing in American democracy, and that is, you know, a president is elected every 4 years, House members every 2 years, senators every 6 years. They have Democratic mandates to carry out the policies they ran for office on. Voters said, I support these policies. So unquestionably, when a president comes into office, unelected career government officials should carry out that president's policies. And that Democratic mandate lies with the elected officials. And I spoke to many career government officials, and they said that they do this. They do carry it out. They say there's laws, and there are laws barring them from engaging in political activities. There was a creation of a civil service to avoid patronage, where you're just appointing people that are politically loyal to you but are not very competent. It started after James Garfield in the 1880s. The then U.S. president was assassinated by a supporter of his who was delusional and expected to be named an ambassador and wasn't named an ambassador. And so when I speak to people who work, spend their lives in government, they say it's an exaggeration what the president's saying. That there is, and I also spoke to current members of the Trump administration who said when there's this use of the term like a coup or a deep state conspiracy, they agreed that that was an exaggeration. Many Republican members of Congress feel that anyone who works for government is kind of inherently more liberal-leaning. There's been a kind of exaltation among conservatives of working in the private sector. I don't think that's true. I think there are conservatives who also work as career government officials. But I don't like the term deep state. It's no one quite knows what it means.
Right.
It's very effective. But again, you know, the bottom line conclusion is that I did not find any evidence of the kind of conspiracy that, you know, the President Trump has talked about by career government officials, that there's a coup or an active plot. And members of his own administration sort of privately agreed with me that that was an exaggeration.
David Rode is our guest this morning. The name of the new book is In Deep, The FBI, the CIA, and the Truth About America's Deep State. So let's talk about those two players, if we can, for a moment, the FBI and the CIA. Two very different agencies, both often cloaked in great secrecy. So when you look into this, what do you find out about their responsibility and ultimately how they work and don't work together that keep this idea going?
So one of the responses to all these scandals in the 70s was to try to create more safeguards, and it was to have oversight of these very powerful, and they're still very powerful and very dangerous agencies, by all the branches of government. So to prevent the FBI from illegally wiretapping Americans, there was a new federal court created in the late 70s called the Federal Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, and that was created back then to prevent sort of abuses of that. The problem with what's happened recently with the FBI is, and listeners might be familiar with this, there was a former Trump campaign advisor, Carter Page,
right,
who the FBI placed under surveillance as part of its Trump-Russia investigation. There was some wrongdoing. Low-level FBI agents changed documents that were in the presentation to the judges on this federal court that made it look like Carter Page. He attracted the interest of the FBI because he was meeting with Russian government officials. A document said that Page was cooperating with the CIA and telling the CIA about these meetings, but an email was changed to say that he was not cooperating with the CIA. It's a low-level lawyer that made this change. Someone close to him told me that it was unintentional or he misunderstood and it wasn't some plot. But, you know, that's wrong. And there was an inspector general. Another thing that was created to oversee these agencies was in the 1970s was these inspectors general who would be non-political and investigate things. They found that two of the four applications for wiretapping of Carter Page were improper, the last two. So it is wrong. Carter Page shouldn't have been surveilled for that long. But again, Carter Page being wiretapped is not, you know, a plot. Trump Tower was never wiretapped. The FBI was investigating, you know, Trump's ties with Russia throughout the 2016 campaign, and they refused to tell, they never leaked that to the public. If they wanted to damage Trump's election chances, the easiest thing they could have done was leak that ongoing investigation. They didn't do it. So it's this pattern again of exaggeration, kind of exaggeration for political gain by President Trump and some of his supporters.
You write in the book, there's a chapter on Reagan, Meese, and Iran-Contra, and you say under Reagan, the CIA experienced the most radical change of any government agency. Without getting in that specifically, I am curious about what an individual administration, what impact it can have on those agencies, both the FBI and the CIA, and ultimately how it changes the quote-unquote deep state of what that means and what it does.
The American system is unusual in that when a new president comes in, normally they appoint about 3,000 political appointees to run federal agencies sort of across the government, and that includes the CIA and the FBI. In Europe, there's very few appointees. There's maybe a few dozen that comes in, and there's a much, you know, larger number of people in the British government or the French government or the German government who are just sort of permanent civil servants. So the president has tremendous powers to sort of see what the FBI is doing. Again, one of the reforms in the 1970s, before then, there would be verbal conversations between a CIA director and a president about carrying out covert action programs. Under new laws that were enacted by President Ford and President Carter, any covert action program by law requires a written finding signed by the president, and then those findings also go to the top members of Congress. And that again, and then another mechanism that was set up are the Congressional Intelligence Committees. And there, both majority and minority members of those committees have subpoena power. They can demand any documents they want to see from the CIA or the FBI. They can haul leaders in to have public hearings. They can have private hearings. All of these systems were set up to try to make sure a president and then other branches, Congress, and then the courts in terms of surveillance are all trying to gain control of these agencies. I was told, and generally by CIA and FBI folks, that they came to accept this system. They like the oversight because there are kind of clear rules of the road.
Right.
The CIA is now barred from operating in the United States. The CIA was barred in the 1970s from carrying out assassinations. And the CIA and FBI officials I talked to say, we agree to this oversight. We follow these procedures. We don't want to have a new president elected and suddenly be told that what we did for the last president was illegal and be sent to jail. And they blame politicians. They say politicians are kind of leaking intelligence and distorting intelligence or attacking the FBI and the CIA for political gain. Many listeners lastly will scoff at me, like, why would I believe the CIA and somebody from the CIA and the FBI over an elected official? But, you know, that's what these career officials told me at both organizations.
The second part of your book is presidential power in the Trump era. And you talk about really going back to, when it comes to Trump, going back to 2001 when he appeared on Good Morning America and even The View and was questioning Barack Obama's birth of whether he was born in the United States. And this whole birther movement was born. You say this form of rhetoric and the way it came to dominate and distort political discourse in the United States would also erode Americans' faith in their government and one another. So with that, and you're writing about the 2016 campaign at the beginning chapter of that section. So where are we now? As you say, you're a mainstream media, put ourselves in that category. And so what does it do because it's mind-boggling, isn't it, that you have a president who is questioning the government that he is, quote-unquote, running?
Well, that's one of the problems is and I would say to conservatives that if you're looking for a news source to trust, I would urge them to read the Wall Street Journal, the news pages in particular. You know, if you're seeing something on Facebook, if you're seeing this extraordinary thing like Barack Obama, the current president of the United States, is not an American citizen, and none of the mainstream media, you know, will cover it, you know, if it's you know, the Wall Street Journal is owned by Rupert Murdoch. He owns Fox News Channel as well. And, you know, if there's a political bias, they're not going to be pro-Obama or, you know, pro the Democrats. But if it's not on the pages of the Wall Street Journal, it's probably not true. Again, the Wall Street Journal has libel laws and all these kind of things like that. But, you know, it's try to trust social media a little bit less and, like, at least kind of standard news organizations that can be sued if they lie a little bit more. I know people are going to scoff, but I do think we're in this sort of cycle of distrust and disdain and conspiracy theory and cable media on the right and the left.
Yes.
You know, you make the crazy, you know, part of the problem is that the whole business model of journalism has kind of collapsed. The way to, you know, get a large audience now is to kind of go right or go left. And that's, I think, what's kind of happening to our discourse. And then to be honest on President Trump, he is an incredibly good communicator. And, you know, what you talked about with the birther thing, it's the same playbook he's been using since 2001. He's very effective at kind of spreading conspiracy theories about his rivals as a way to discredit them. And I found that he's increasingly, you know, shrouding his own actions and the actions of his own administrations in secrecy.
So what does that mean for the 2020 election? And because you have Donald Trump, who you just described, going up against Joe Biden, who would be just a perfect example, I think, out of Trump's playbook of being someone who has long been a part of the deep state.
Yes. I mean, Joe Biden was elected to office, so I think that's different. And this is why I don't like the term deep state. Like, if you like government, you'll say Joe Biden's a public servant, you know, or you'll say a career government worker, you know, is a government expert. If you hate government, then you'll say, you know, a career politician is a hack, and that, you know, and the government worker's a pencil pusher. So I think this is a real test. I think the coronavirus has shown, you know, that it's important to have basic facts. And if we can't agree on basic fact, you know, how dangerous is the coronavirus? Do we need to shut down, you know, states? Then we can't really function, I think, as a healthy democracy and society. And my worry is that with President Trump, I spoke to an aide who worked with him in the past, and he said that President Trump feels very frustrated. He'll kind of give his aides an order. He wanted to, let's say, pull all U.S. troops out of Syria, and no one would carry it out. And so he was increasingly kind of tweeting his policies out without really discussing them with his team and a broader team of experts. But, you know, Trump feels, he says he's besieged by the media. And, you know, going back to what President Trump himself is doing, you know, whether it's out of fear or calculation, you know, he barred his aides from testifying before Congress during the impeachment hearings. He's increasingly, you know, refusing to respond to requests for subpoenas from Congress for documents. But so he's working more with a small group of loyalists. He's sort of creating a parallel shadow government filled with like-minded allies. I mentioned the book Rudy Giuliani, sort of carrying out a private foreign policy. And so this government he's forming without transparency, without democratic norms, without any sort of public process, you know, ironically, Donald Trump is creating a deep state of his own.
David Rode is a 2-time Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. His new book is In Deep, The FBI, the CIA, and the Truth About America's Deep State. It is published by Norton. David Rode, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for sharing with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Be well. Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is In Deep, The FBI, the CIA, and the Truth About America's Deep State. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.